Okay, today is July 20th, 2005. This is Adam Gregg interviewing Elwood Whitey Iverson about his World War II experience. Okay, Whitey, could we start out, just say your the date and place of your birth?
Well, my birth was February 23rd, 1921, little town of Meckling, South Dakota. We lived on a farm, a large farm, right south of Meckling, next to the Missouri River in South Dakota.
Okay, and is that where you grew up then?
Yes, basically that's where I did. I attended. There was only 40 and 45 kids in high school and 12 in my class. And, of course, it's during the 30s, and there's no jobs available afterwards. So I joined what they call a CCC camp, Civilian Conservation Corps. And that was one of Roosevelt's deal to employ unemployed young people throughout the nation. And we were based in the Black Hills, and our work consisted of working on Harney Peak and Mount Rushmore, the Wind Cave, Bluebell Lodge, and doing a lot of conservation work, fighting fires, and just about anything you could think of. And we got $30 a month for our labor and plus board and room. And we worked under the Forestry Service during the day, and the Army took us over at night. So we were under Army regulations and behavior during the evening hours. And it was a wonderful experience because I saved all of $85 in 2 years, and that put me through my first year of college, believe it or not. And of course I had a football scholarship that paid board and room and everything like that, and so it was a very enrichment type of experience.
Okay, and where did you go to college?
Well, I went to a little two-year college at Springfield, South Dakota at that time. That's called Southern State Normal, and then I transferred to the University of South Dakota and was majoring in phys ed, and then after the war I attended the University of Nebraska and got a degree in agronomy and agricultural education.
Okay, and could you talk a little bit about your experience working on Mount Rushmore?
Well, they would drop us off there in the morning at about 8 o'clock in a forester truck, and this was mostly in the summertime and into the late fall, and our job was to haul scaffolding up the top of the faces and take down the drilling bits that they needed to have them sharpened. A little shop there on the base of Mount Rushmore. And there was about 28 of us at that time, young men, working there. Plus the drillers from Germany, there were about 20 of them there. Most of them were from Germany. And it was quite an experience for a kid who lived on the farm and never had the opportunity to get out before. And I didn't realize the importance of Mount Rushmore at that time. I just thought it was a job. And I didn't really find out until after the war was over how important the job was. But it was a job, and I didn't think it was dangerous. We had ropes to let us down over the face, and we had to do some work. And I think one thing I remember is somebody tipped over a 5 gallon paint, a red can of paint, and it dribbled out over Washington's nose, and we had to go down and scrub that off and hang in there in a swing seat over the edge of the face. But I thought that was fun. But so we had those experiences, and of course along with that experience we got paid pretty well. $30 a month in our boardroom.
Okay, and what were your thoughts as war was breaking out in Europe, and before the U.S. even became involved? What were your thoughts on that international situation?
I can remember exactly what happened in September 1939. I think Germany marched into Poland. I think the date was September 9th, and I was on my bunk in a basement of the administration building. There's 23 students in that basement, and we got the facilities free if we'd just clean up the coal bins and sleep in there. And I remember lying in the bunk, and the war broke out, and we knew that eventually we'd have to go. I was going to join the National Guard immediately for a little money, and but that day I guess I had sinus trouble, couldn't get down for the physical. And the 23 boys who did go down and sign up, they were shipped about a year later to the Philippines and made the Bataan Death March. And I'll tell you, it was just because I had a cold, I didn't get in to enlist in that group. So that's part of the thing that broke out that I remember very well because of the fact that of the war in the clouds in Germany there.
And what about when the U.S. was brought into the war with the attack at Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was at the University of South Dakota, and one of the professors drove up in the filling station. I was working there on Sundays, and he said, "You hear the latest news?" And this is 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon, and he told me that we had been attacked. And I think that everybody, we didn't go to school that next 2 days. We just, everybody just took off. And of course, you either had to get drafted or enlist. So I enlisted, of course, in reserve. And then I went in August, I think in 1942. So people just kind of dropped their books and, because they knew what was happening. So that's about it.
Okay, and what branch of the service did you join?
Army,
what?
Air Force. Yeah. See, the Air Force didn't exist then, it was known today. It was under the Army, Air Force. And it was, they had two, they didn't have enough instructors for flight training, so they had to give us civilians. So I worked under civilian instructors for many months. And first we started out with the light plane, and then we went to the double wing WACOs and stuff like that, and we'd done a lot of basic training, acrobatics, cross-country work, instrument work, just general flying. And so that was the extent of it. And finally we got into advanced training, of course, and could do that later. But that's about it.
Okay. What do you suppose drew you to that branch of the service?
Well, we had a airport about 3 miles from the farm. And if you were going to University of South Dakota that time, you had a chance to get in what they call civilian pilot training in the 40s, early 40s. And they would pay for your, the government would pay for your flying lessons. So I thought, boy, that's a pretty good deal. So I started flying Piper Cubs. And that's my interest was that it was kind of fun. So I stayed with it, and that's basically what I wanted to get into. And I didn't, just marching around on the ground didn't appeal to me.
So how did you feel about joining then?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I'll tell you one fact. World War II difference is different from any other war because we were attacked, of course, at Pearl Harbor. But everybody wanted to be involved. You either enlisted, or you enlisted in defense work, or you stayed on the farm, and of course you had rationing set in. But they needed farmers for food, of course. But the main thing is that the women were involved in defense contracts, and the men who were disabled or had something wrong with their health, they could get into defense factories. But it was almost a disgrace if you didn't do something. And if you didn't go, there were several kids that got out of it somehow. But they, during the night, somebody'd come and paint yellow paint on their buildings called Slacker. And right over here west of Haywarden, there was a building there, stood there for a long time. And I don't know who lived there, but that was west there by Sphinx, South Dakota. And a big Slacker was 1948 that would come over here from Nebraska. And there was that name, the name was still there. But it was quite a deal, and everybody wanted to be involved because, and it was just whole nation was drawn together. We didn't have any exemption, you know, like we have years ago that you could get out of it some way, but most people wanted to go.
Okay. Could we expand a little bit and talk some more about your training experience?
Well, our training experience is in three phases. First, we were shipped to Santa Ana, California, and what they call a pre-flight. And there we took aerodynamics, math, we took navigation, engine power plants, and then we were shipped to there to Bozeman, Montana, where we had pre-flight training again, and because we didn't have room for all of us, we didn't have instructors, so they put us in Bozeman, Montana, and we had mountain flying up there, and with the small plane, and they taught us the rudiments of flight training in the mountainous country. And then we were shipped there from Dos Palos, California, where we had acrobatics and flight training quite extensively. And then from there, that was the primary course. And the secondary course was at Merced, California. And that was flying a heavier type of fighter plane. It was quite an experience. We had a lot of instrument work, a lot of acrobatics again. And it was very extensive. And my biggest thrill, I think, my instructor the last day, he was a crop duster. And most of the instructors were civilians. And coming into the field, we had cotton fields all around us out there. He turned that plane upside down, and we flew 2 miles in the field. I don't think we were over 10 feet above the ground. And I was hanging, it was an open cockpit plane, and I was hanging by my seatbelt. I bet I dropped a foot out of that into the slipstream. And he always felt that if you didn't believe in Christianity before you got in the plane, you didn't get out. And then we went from there. Every step they examined you and give you tests and everything else like that, flying tests. And then we went to advanced training down in Texas. Marfa, Texas, and that was just a little ways from the Mexican border. If you crossed over the border and had the engine trouble, you got interned there for the duration of the war. But anyhow, that was advanced twin engine on what called UC-78 plane, and it was quite an airplane. That the constant vibration was when you're flying it. Of course, they had old props and stuff, and the instruments was all the instruments were not sophisticated at all. And the radio was Morse code, and you had to, when you come in for an instrument landing, you had to make sure the end signal was on one side and the O on the other side, and you had to stay in that border. And so it was quite interesting how you got trained along that area, because a lot of kids, like to say, off the farm, 9 months later, you're ready to go overseas. And so we got through that, and I remember that I finished one day early. My instructor said, well, you're all through now. You're ready to get your commission. And I remember that he come and finally got a hold of me at the barracks. He said, the commanding general from the Western Flying Training Command at Denver is here, and he wants to check some students. And he says, you're all through. So he said, you're going to give him a check ride. And I'm telling you, this is a guy that had a cigar in his mouth and cigar chomping guy. And I never will forget him, because he got in the plane and he says, well, take it off. And he said, I'll tell you what to do. And we happened to have a plane that was just absolutely the worst plane on the airbase. It just didn't work right, and the instruments didn't work, and we couldn't get the landing gear down. And finally he said, he took it over, and he said, I'll show you how to fly. Well, he didn't the worst job than I did. And he was all over the sky, and he couldn't make anything work. And finally he said, well, let's just fly around and look at the country. So we did. Come in for landing, and I made a pretty good landing for him. And I remember my instructor come up, and he was kind of concerned about it, because if his student didn't do well, it meant that probably he didn't get an advance in a commission rating. So after about 10 minutes, I was waiting there, and he came out and he says, boy, you must have really done a fabulous job flying that guy. He said, he'd give you an A for the test. And I didn't say anything. I just let him think that I was a hot fried pilot. And it was the worst ride I ever had. But anyhow, and then you went into advanced training from there. That sent you into Luke Field, and that was P-38 fighters. And they were fast. They were 450, 500 mile an hour. And they had two 1,500 horsepower engines in them, 12 cylinders. And it was, you sat between the two engines, and it had twin boom on the back. And it was an airplane that was really at advanced stage. The only one that was faster than that was probably the P-51. So we got a lot of experience there. And gunnery, we had to go out and have gunnery shoot at a plastic tube that the other airplanes were towing about 500 feet back up. And you'd make approach on this, and you had colored wax bullets. I mean, the end of the bullet was red, green, or whatever it was, and it would make a mark on that, what you call it, so they knew who was shooting at it. And that's the way they trained us for shooting, and shooting at this towed target with a P-38. And it was quite, it's really interesting. And we had one experiment where they had a B-25 bomber there, and that was a twin engine, medium-sized bomber. And they were going to put a 18-foot barrel on that thing as a tank buster. It would shoot a 75-millimeter shell, and it had a recoil mechanism, and it went the full length of the plane practically, and then it went right between the pilot and the co-pilot and went out the front of the airplane. And we had never shot it before, so we had a tank down there, an old worn-out tank we were going to shoot it at. We come low over that plane, over that tank, and we let that thing go, and I'll tell you, every broke every instrument in our plane. It's just like that plane stopped still in the air. Dust flew, and it just absolutely, even the rivets, it took the rivets loose. Well, we landed the thing, and that was the last time they ever experimented with that thing. And so it was kind of a funny experience. And but that was the training flights, and we flew out at Gila Bend, Arizona. As one day it was 126 degrees, I remember that. And we would take our sheets and for the evening, during the evening, and put them in the shower, throw them in the bed, and then evaporation of the water would cool us down. It was, but it lasted about 15 minutes, they'd be bone dry. And then the little lizards from the desert would come in during the night because it was cool in there. And then they would get up in the morning, turn a light on, those literally thousands of little skinks, about 3-4 inches long, would be on the floor, and they'd get out of the way, and it was just that way. But everybody lived under those circumstances, never thought anything of it. And but it was quite an experience for, like I said, the kid that never had much experience along that line. But they enjoyed having Midwestern kids from the farm and stuff like that, because they were used to probably more adverse conditions than a kid from New York or West Coast. But it was interesting.
Okay, and so once you were well-trained, mm-hmm. Did you feel you were well-trained, I guess?
While you're trained, if you survive, you're well-trained, because we had very basic radios. And I remember one night, we had this old 7C-47, which is a troop transport. Trained on that. That was an old airliner. They converted it to what they call a C-47. It was commonly known in the civilian life as a DC-3. And they converted it to call it a C-47. And everybody would land at the air base, and they'd say, have you ever stopped at Winslow, Arizona? And he said, that's really a place that's a lot of fun down there, nightlife and everything else. Well, we thought, well, we're going to pretend we have engine trouble, so we landed in there. And the airport runway was under construction. We could land, but we couldn't take off again. And we were there for 3 days. 99%, we went to a show one night, 99% Mexicans in there. And they had a John Wayne movie and a cowboy, and I'll tell you, every time he'd shoot somebody, they'd stand up and cheer. It's smelly, and it was hot in there. It wasn't air-conditioned. And a bed, we had a bed above the railroad station. So every time a train comes through at night, the whole beds would just jump and vibrate. And So it was quite an experience there. And after we got out of there, we happened to tell everybody that we knew that, boy, you want us to have a good time, stop at Winslow. There wasn't anything to do there. But, and then one night we flew into Tinkerfield, Oklahoma during a rainstorm, and we had 50 barrels of oil, and their barrels were cardboard, pressed cardboard, because steel was short, and there were 55-gallon drums made out of pressed cardboard. And they worked all right. But we were coming in at night, and it was raining in a thunderstorm, and we felt a hump just coming in about 100 feet off the ground. And I'll be son of a gun, we'd hit the telephone wires going into the city. And we dug those wires all the way down the runway. We knocked out all the telephone service in the city of Oklahoma. And it wasn't our fault because the lights were out. The storm had knocked all the landing lights out. So all we had was the landing lights in the plane. They were just inferior, probably. So it was kind of interesting. Some of the experiences we had. And a bunch of fine kids. We had a class reunion here in 19, so out in Colorado Springs, the 50th anniversary, and 125 showed up out of 200, and that was pretty good because this is 50 years afterwards, and we had reminisced, of course, about all the things we had done, but their main job was being trained for air transport. And air transport was supplying supplies and picking up new planes at the factories and taking to the proper air bases and modification center, which would put new guns on them, install wing tanks, stuff like that. But it was a total effort as far as effort is concerned. It was just important for the Air Transport Command in the States to get the planes where they had to be at the takeoff point. To Seattle or Los Angeles for the Pacific and New York for the Atlantic. And I never did make a trip overseas because we were busy in the States here being trained and stuff like that in the training period. And because I think when I come ready to get discharged at Lincoln, Nebraska, there's 100,000 pilots waiting to get discharged. So I did get a chance to fly, get my air transport command license, which was for civilian airliners. And I got that right up there in the wall. But it was interesting, life ahead.
So now that you've been trained, where did you serve and what did you do?
Just actually flew around the country hauling transport supplies. That's just about it, because you're Air Transport Command. About a month before the war was over, I was assigned to towed lighters and Damascus Field, North Carolina. Well, before I could get down to the war was over. So a lot of time we just sat around waiting for planes and training and more training and more training. Because every day you trained, and especially instrument work. Because to get a green card in instrument work, you had to have 100 hours of actual instrument flying. And I mean, that was under the hood or complete clouds. I mean, you couldn't see the ground or anything, you had to come in. But that was 100 hours of actual flying instruments. And you kind of work your way down until you saw the runway, and that was it, and you opened it. You'd get too low. But so they had various types of training periods in the Air Force at that time, and we were assigned to one time we went through Missouri, a little air base down there, and they practiced low-level flying in among the trees. I don't think any time we're much over 10 or 15 feet above the ground, and we had to practice low-level flying in that period, and that was about a 50-mile stretch down through the trees. And that was supposed to be a train us for, in case they needed, during the wartime, more information or intelligence on troops and stuff for the enemy. And then we had short field takeoffs and landings we had to make. They put us in a paddock with a fence, we had to first take off downwind, and we turned and put the wing on the ground as we were turning, full throttle, and then come over, get over that fence. And then landing, short field landings, you had to come over the same fence, but you'd bounce it on the ground on one side of the fence, so the plane would bounce on the other side. And that was that type of training. It was screwball training once in a while, because this is the first time the Air Force ever operated as an Air Force. We never had any experience. When World War II broke out, they had 17 bombers in the United States, 17 of them. And that was very few of them. I don't know how we ever got, they made 20, I think. I have a large book on plane. I think they eventually manufactured about 22 different models of airplanes, but they only got about 10 of them in battle. The rest of them were just one or two makes of each one. And when they got through with them, then during the last part of the war, we flew into Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we flew a lot of planes that had been in combat and wanted to get rid of them. So we flew them down to Albuquerque, and they drained all the gas and oil out of them, took a crane, and blew them up, smashed them, and we had a big press down there, pressed them up into a ball of aluminum. Boy, war is very expensive, and as far as I'm concerned, it's just a fallacy. That's the reason why I guess I'm kind of bitter about this Iraq war. I don't think it was necessary myself. And I'm, of course, a pretty strong Republican, but I don't know anymore.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I just don't feel that. I don't feel it made the right decisions. I don't think that the first preemptive strike we've ever made in our life in this country, on another country. And looking at it right now, you can just absolutely see here we lost, I think, close to 1,800 Americans, and we've lost about 20,000 as severely wounded. And we've lost, I think the statistics now are over 100,000 Iraqis that have died one way or the other. It's hard to count. And I think, look back for what? And I think we stirred up a hornet's nest over there, and I think we're going to see it for a long time. I really feel sorry for those kids over there fighting. I think they got guts to go there, and it's a different war. You can't use the $20 million airplane over there hardly. It's on the ground fighting. And then when I think of the cost, the estimated $500 billion, and I think what we could have done with that, housing, education, buildings, everything. Just absolutely shot. And I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I just feel that we made a mistake. I really did. And I think that, I don't know, I'm not much of a George Bush fan, I'll have to tell you that right now. And I don't care for Cheney, or I don't care for Rumsfeld. I think it's kind of a closed, very closed, secretive administration. And if you don't march to their tune, you can be out. But I think we've got some very fine senators and congressmen in there that are really doing a real good job. But I think they are fighting a battle of secrecy, too. I don't know. It's an interesting... What's going to happen in the next few years? I think we saw the best in the Americans during World War II. It brought out the best of everybody. But after World War II and the Vietnam War, and it was just a tough one. It changed the whole culture in this country. And I just feel it's frustrating. So you believe something, and yet you don't. You kind of lied to tell the truth about it. I don't know.
What did you think about the Vietnam War?
Oh, I think that was a big mistake too, but we didn't get enough troops in there to curtail the deal, and it's too bad. It's just a lot of good people who come home, they're spat on, and we had a terrible time during the Vietnam War here. Demonstrations, and it was just, we had, the country was split wide open. And I think there's a danger of the country being split off in the next few years if this thing doesn't end within a couple of years. I really believe it. And I think the result of this, we're not too popular overseas, but we went over there, Vi and I have taken trips we first went to England, and then we took another trip to England, up to Scotland and around, and we were treated very, very well. Then we went to Germany, the second time, second tour, and Holland and France and Austria, all those places. And I'd hate to make the trip today. I don't think the Americans are too popular in some spots. I'm not going to say it's not popular ever some places, but you've been over there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe England's different, but I don't think the English people really supported this Iraqi war either.
Can you relate, do you think, in any way, your views on Vietnam, on Iraq, to your military experience serving in World War II? Is there any kind of connection there?
Well, no, because I was too old to be called back. But I do know that talking to people who've been over there and visiting with people who've been there recently, it's a beautiful country, Vietnam is, from what I can gather. And the people are just really wonderful people. And I think it's just too bad that it had to happen. Now, France was, they were in there for a while, and they left, you know, early in the game. And I guess they probably were smarter than we were, I don't know. But it just was one of those places that we shouldn't have been, I don't think. We're under the auspices of then to contain communism. And I don't know. I think the people solved that question for themselves later on. It's maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it was worth it. Time will tell, but I don't think it was myself. But we lost a lot of wonderful people. I lost 4 or 5 students over there. And it was tough. Right here in town. And I lost, talk about why you don't care for war. I lost on the first football team in Springfield, there was only 4 survivors, including myself. The coach even got killed when he wore World War II. And all those kids never, and the University of South Dakota. I think there was 3 of us survivors from the football team that I played with, and all of them were killed in World War II. And a good friend of mine was killed in a surf off Okinawa coming in, and never did find his body or anything else. And that's nasty. You see the fun part of and experiences you had, but really war is just a downright dirty mess. Because I've seen families that have lost people, and I've had good friends died over there in the Bulge. And they took the Bulge, they took Air Force people. They had to have men, so they just flew them over. No infantry experience whatsoever. And they were killed within 2 or 3 days. The Germans put on that big drive. It was terrible. I suppose World War II was worth it if you look at it. If we hadn't done this, and just a decision of Hitler, if we hadn't done what we did, maybe it'd been different over in Europe. I don't know. But I see too much of this where it's split up families. Even today, I see young families lose a kid, you know. I don't know. I'm not much of a war deal. I think there's much more we can do with our country and assets and than fight wars. That's my opinion. I don't know how you agree with me or not. But
this is about you.
This is about me.
This is about you. You mentioned losing some of your friends
in the good
beaches
ones.
At Okinawa. Good friends.
Oh, yeah.
At the Bulge.
Yeah. Wayne Carmody was his name from the University of South Dakota. Young fellow, nice looking. Oh, he was going to go to law school and everything else like that. Just never had a chance. But I could name dozens of them. Wayne Smith and just all of them in there. And then a lot of them were wounded badly. Some of them are lost legs, and some of them nervous breakdowns. You know, it's like I said, the dark side of war is what's when you end up half it's over with. As we see the, and we're experiencing that in Iraq. You know, you go into Washington D.C., Letterman's Hospital there, and boy, the. In fact, the administration doesn't want to allow the coffins coming to be photographed, you know, coming back. And during World War, Vietnam War, there always were, because it kind of tells the people what the cost of war is. But they're, I don't know. It's a little different deal.
Can you remember when you heard about some of your friends?
Oh yeah, I was with them. We lost, I saw a B-29 bomber disintegrate a mile from me, right in the middle air, 35,000 feet, just blew up. And I saw parachutes come down, half of them didn't get down. I have a good friend of mine from Jefferson, South Dakota, Floyd Penn. He trained with us and he was killed in a training accident, flew into the side of a mountain. We lost a lot of people in training. And it was tough because at night, the bed wasn't there, and that was it. But you sure grew up in a hurry, I'll tell you that. But you take a lot of kids who are just 17, 18, a good friend of mine out in Moses Lake, Washington today, he was, I think, 17 or 18 when, and started flying. And a lot of those guys were 19 years old, and they're total in command of a B-7 big bomber. Getting that experiences. An old pilot was 23 years old, 25. That was an old man. Kind of young today. So you kind of had a growing up period there that gave you a lot of responsibility in a hurry.
In what ways did you feel like you grew up during World War II?
Well, I think it's just the idea that you had this total responsibility put on you. You had, if you were carrying 2-3 men with you. The honor system was developed very strongly. And I have to go back this way in the classroom. If you were made a mistake or if you were checking in the barracks, let's say at night, and you're supposed to be in at 9 o'clock and you come in at 9:05, you signed yourself in at 9:05. That's the honor system. And that made a difference. Because that, even though you got five gigs for every minute you were late, that meant Sunday afternoon, you walked out on the ramp with a parachute hitting you in the back of the legs for 2 hours or 5 hours. And you grow up in conditions like that. And when you lose your best buddy, you grow up a little bit. And it just makes you grow up. It's tough. And of course, there was no automobiles available then. Public transportation was 100%, and had to get around. And it was not fun.
What was your family life like at about this time? Had you met Vi yet?
Met her before the war, and we just decided not to get married until war was over. And if she found somebody else, that's fine. If I found somebody else, we didn't get engaged or anything. We didn't get engaged until, I guess the summer I was about ready to get discharged and engaged and married a month later. It lasted 60 years. And we had a Dr. Hardapple was our kid I flew with. And he was the best man. And Vi had two of her girlfriends stand up. There's five of us at the wedding. Cornhusker Hotel down in Lincoln, Nebraska. And well, I think the wedding dinner was $10 at that time. You'd buy a steak dinner for a dollar. And it was... No, I had met them. We didn't get married till after the war was just about over.
Did you try and keep in touch with her while you were in the service?
Yeah, a letter or two. Not too much. I didn't get to see her. We couldn't get around. Couldn't get home. I didn't see her till after the war was over. So.
And what about your family at home?
Never did get home. No. When I've last... the last... 2 months I was at Lincoln, Nebraska waiting for a discharge, but we had to keep flying. And I remember we had a B-25 bomber. And we had it full of guys that wanted to, we had nothing to do but just fly. So we flew to Minneapolis and Colorado and Denver, and we had to get so many hours a month in to get our flight pay. But I remember we buzzed the farm that day. And I could see my dad down there, and I think we were about 50 feet above the barn buildings, and I waved at him out through the window and scattered the livestock through the fences and everything. And a neighbor was hunting geese all morning, and we flew down over this cornfield. I bet we weren't 20 feet tall, and we scattered the geese from one end to another. And he was waved a shotgun at me. But I hadn't been home, and then another funny thing was the B-25 had a plastic bubble on its nose. And it had a little drawer for the gun to go through, plastic gun. And there's no guns at that time. We took them off. And the guy sitting in the front of the plastic nose reading a Western novel, and some guys were back in the back of the plane poker. And we're flying along there, and finally he kicked something. I don't know what it was. He moved and had that little plastic door, and it come loose, and a blast of air come through that plane. It took the magazines, the poker chips, everything just plastered to the back. Just cleaned house. And he had to sit around. He had the rest of the flight to Denver, Colorado, and back to Lincoln. He had to sit with his rear end in that hole. And I never will forget that as long as I live, because we couldn't get that door back on. But those old planes, they leaked oil and everything else. And but we'd fly them. We never thought much about it.
Have any other funny stories like that?
Well, I was at Lincoln, Nebraska once, and I had to get back to Tucson, Arizona. I went up to see Vi. And we'd hitchhike around the country by hitchhiking on Army planes. If they were going here, we'd get a ride. And I never will forget this plane. It was a Lockheed twin-engine plane, and I had never flown one in my life. And this colonel said I could ride with him. He had to go to Tinkerfield, Oklahoma. And boy, I didn't realize that he'd been drunk the night before, and he was just out. We taxied down the end of the runway. He got up, unbuckled his chute, and he said, "You're going to fly this airplane to Tinker. I'm going to back and sleep." And there, I'd never flown a place that plane in my life. And I sat there for 5 minutes and looked at some of the instruments and got everything ready, took off, and got bit down there, but that was kind of funny, I think of it. But I wouldn't do it now. I'm too conservative, but then you think of it. You had to have young kids flying then, because they just do anything, you know. And I remember, too, also, I'm an acrobatic soar out in California. We were up at about 15,000 feet in the clouds. We'd get in the clouds, we were playing Follow the Leader. And there were about four of us. And we'd go in these clouds and in and out to try to lose them. And I thought I'd lost everybody. And I looked back in my rearview mirror, and there was my buddy right on my tail. I don't think that prop was 10 feet away. and he was just grinning at me. But that was kind of fun deals we had then. But in our training, we'd have extra time. We'd do that, you know. Our most fun deal was tipping over sailboats out in the Laguna Beach in California. We hated civilians at that time. So we saw somebody out sailing, we just fly low enough so the prop horse could catch a sail and flip it over. And that was our hobby. So we'd had a lot of fun, but most of the time it wasn't training. You just kind of had to have a positive outlook. Because if you sat around and were depressed or you'd do yourself no good. So you just accepted the fact you were there. And that's the way most guys did. I think they finished their missions and got it over with. And there was a big Air Force right here in the United States that had to work in the Air Transport Division and training and everything else. Because it just wasn't, we got caught in the Pearl Harbor deal. We didn't have any equipment whatsoever. The planes we had, I'm telling you, some of them wonder how we ever made it, but we did.
What do you suppose it was that influenced you to keep going all the time? Or, I guess, what was it that motivated you?
Oh, I just enjoyed flying. I really